We now return to the Sunday afternoon movie, Masturbator and Commander.
Captain, the enemy ship has opened fire on us.
I'll be right out.
Sir, we've already lost 10 men.
Hang on.
Sir, don't you think we should return fire?
Yeah, go ahead and do that, and I'll meet you up there in like 5 minutes.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere, like, such
as. I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie! Out!
Our next-door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
I've listened to your podcast so much, it's always strange to hear someone speak back to you, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I get myself, I'm so out of the habit of talking extemporaneously on one of these recordings. I'm so used to having my script in front of me. This is very different.
I think it's always fun to have the element of surprise, you know, in these extemporaneous conversations.
Surprise, fitting, right?
Yes, exactly.
I think we're going to end up speaking a lot about Nelson on this episode, just because he's such a fascinating figure.
Oh, yeah, he's a great character. It's funny, I actually, rewatching the movie last night, there's that scene where they talk about Nelson, and it just kind of got me thinking about him again. You know, I set out to do 2 episodes about him, and I wound up doing 4, so that tells you something.
Okay, let's start the show formally before we get too far in the weeds.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Trudano.
As you may have guessed from our questions and from the voice of our guests, we are talking today about Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, from 2003, a historical fiction film set during the Napoleonic Wars, starring Russell Crowe as Captain Jack Aubrey and Paul Bettany as the ship's doctor, Stephen Maturin. And to discuss this excellent film, we are joined by Everett Rubbinge from the Age of Napoleon podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So why are we doing this 20-year-old film that, you know, didn't spawn maybe the franchise that its creators wanted it to?
This is a Napoleonic War film, one of the few that exists, and we're soon to get a very big one coming from Ridley Scott, his Napoleon movie. What were your thoughts on the trailer, Everett?
Well, I could probably go off on this for the entire runtime of the podcast. I'll try to keep it brief. But first off, I'll say Ridley Scott is, no offense to the movie we're discussing today, but he is the director of my personal favorite movie about the Napoleonic Wars, The Duelists, which was his first project, his first big project, a big passion project for him, something he made pretty much on his own. And it's really a beautiful film, well written, well acted. And really, I think they got the Napoleonic Wars. That movie is about kind of the ethos of a soldier of that era. And they really did a good job exploring that, getting into it. It very much feels like it's of the time. It even looks like it's of the time. They did a wonderful job with the sets and the locations. So that alone, I would say, is reason to be hopeful for this Napoleon picture. Because this guy, I think, well, at least back in the 70s when he was first starting his career, he really understood this era. So that's reason to be hopeful.
He is the master of historical fiction, for sure. He does every era. Roman, medieval, Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
There are no limits.
What do you make of the Twitter discourse around this film? I've seen some takes that I kind of roll my eyes at about Napoleon, good or bad, and that's going to decide whether or not he's apt to have a movie made about him. What do you make of some of these conversations on Twitter?
I mean, yes, I've seen those same conversations, and I have also rolled my eyes at them. To me, even going beyond just this one movie, I think that's a very simplistic and not very fruitful way to look at this era. You know, I think people kind of want to shoehorn their view of World War II into this era, because it does, in many ways, it is very reminiscent of World War II. But there just are not clear-cut good guys and bad guys in this era of history the way that there were in the 1940s. That was a very unique thing that happened in history in the 1940s. And I think people are really kind of almost stuck, because there is so much discussion of World War II in academia, popular culture, wherever you look. I think people are kind of stuck in that framework and have a hard time with someone who is quite ambiguous, a figure mm-hmm. who has good, bad, in between things that maybe were terrible but had positive outcomes. You know, that kind of gray stuff is really not, in particular, to what Twitter does well. And I think in general, yes. what our culture does not do very well right now.
One thing I'm looking forward to in the movie, and they only faintly gestured towards this in the trailer, but in your podcast, I think the most fascinating part for me was always how emotionally affected by Josephine Napoleon seemed to be. And so even though he was commanding these large armies, he seemed very histrionic when it came to his wife or girlfriend being maybe angry with him or upset with him.
Oh, yeah. Their view of masculinity was very different back then. And to us, that seems so silly that this guy who was a great warlord and a great military leader and a statesman and kind of a decisive masculine personality, it seems a bit silly that he was so enthralled to not only Josephine. I mean, he was a inveterate womanizer and he got kind of obsessed with all kinds of women over the course of his life. And it's a side of him that to us, I think, looks kind of weak. But in this era, for a French man, that was sort of expected to be this sort of, I don't know, bleeding heart romantic, writing these sort of desperate, sad love poems to women. That was expected. And it is a bit funny, though.
Okay, so just to make sure that we can fit in our entire discussion of master and commander, colon, the far side of the world, let's get started on our discussion of that. So we've talked a lot on this pod about how the 2000s very much changed the way that the movie business operated. And in the 2010s, Bob Iger had taken control of Disney, and after he had acquired Marvel and Star Wars and doubled Disney's film profit margins to 21%, he reflected on what had changed about the movie business. And he said the biggest difference is that people look at making movies like a real business, which, you know, thank God that the bean counters are now in control of the movie business. And in 2003, Hollywood is under this increased pressure to create franchises because their revenues are more predictable. And there were two Age of Sail movies that came out, both adaptations of existing IP, both intending to anchor a franchise, and one was based on a series of 20 insanely well-received historical novels. And the other one was based on a theme park ride. And guess which one got the franchise? The one based on the theme park ride. And so in this episode, we'll explore why the theme park ride had more sea legs than the 20-part best-selling book series.
Yeah, and I think this movie also, it's a bit of an outlier in the decade's approach to making historical fiction, period pieces, sword and sandals, whatever you want to call them. Although I think you need to really squint to call the Napoleonic War sword and sandals. But we talked on our episode about Ridley Scott's Robin Hood, we had this trend of movies that purport to be quote unquote the real story, you know, the story behind the legend. So you see this with most famously Robin Hood, but something like Gladiator purports to be based on a true story. The Emperor Commodus, who did dabble in gladiatorial fighting. The Troy movie acts as all of the gods. We're going to give you the real deal. And of course, all of these movies end up being totally ahistorical and inaccurate and all of that. But what's fascinating about this movie, why it's the outlier, is that it's not realistic in that these characters aren't real, but it's very authentic from what I understand. It captures the feel of the period, but the events that it portrays did not happen, nor does the movie claim that they happened. So it's kind of the opposite of the Robin Hood movie that we talk about. And I think my theory is that this kind of threw some people off. How to approach historically grounded fiction is something that audiences didn't really take to. Everett, do you have any theories on why audiences didn't quite know how to take this film, or why we never got a sequel because of that?
Well, it's funny that you put it that way, because I wrote down something very similar in my notes when I was rewatching it last night. You know, I was thinking about the fact that you guys are talking about a decade, the period in which this movie came out. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, this is actually not a very good representation of that decade.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, in a lot of ways, kind of a movie out of time. You know, it feels like out of step with what was going on in popular culture at that time. One thing that struck me funny. You know, I've seen this movie a million times, and any movie you see that many times, different things jump out at you. And one thing that really jumped out at me this time was how earnest this movie is.
Yes.
There's actually even a scene where I think that they almost tell you, we're being earnest here, we're wearing our hearts on our sleeves, you've got to kind of take the leap with us, which is that scene where Captain Aubrey tells the story about Nelson being offered a cloak and saying, I don't need a cloak because my zeal for king and country keep me warm. And Aubrey basically says outright, if it had been anyone else in the world saying that, I would have rolled my eyes and thought it was corny. But from Nelson, it moved me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's almost like the director telling you, you know, hey, you've got to take these guys at face value. They don't have the same values that you do. They don't have the same worldview that you do. You've got to kind of take the leap and try to see the world through their eyes and see that they are serious about fighting for their country and they're serious about their faith in God. Even Dr. Maturin, I love that they have that little part where you kind of might suspect that that guy's an atheist or something, but he clearly is not. And so I think that that's maybe something that people are just not primed to see that at the movies anymore, I don't think. Especially not from a big budget Hollywood production with recognizable stars in it.
Yeah, 100%. I feel like it's either going to be something that's very cynical, which this movie is not, or it's going to be something that's incredibly self-aware. Whereas this movie is, as you said, earnest and genuine. This ship is England, as he says.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so the tone of the movie is a big part of our discussion today, because I think it's very important for understanding why it may not have been received like other potential franchises at this time.
And yeah, I guess since we have you and you're the expert, how authentically does this film portray life on a ship in the Napoleonic Wars?
Well, I'll start with the caveat that much like Napoleon himself, I am a land guy, not a sea guy.
Yes.
So if this was a movie, you know, if we were talking about the Duelists, I'd be able to go into all kinds of detail about the lives of the army soldiers. I'm a little bit less familiar with the ocean stuff, but with that caveat, it is quite accurate. There's a couple little things that jump out at me. For instance, there's a scene where a character says to another character, are you okay? No, that would not happen on a British warship of that era. Mm-hmm. Okay was, as far as we can tell, obscure American backcountry slang at that point. The idea that a British lord is saying that to a British officer is just not plausible. It's also, it's very unclear. They say that the Acheron, that the ship that they're chasing, is a privateer. It sort of does not quite, the things that we know about the ship sort of do not quite track with that. And the officers all seem to be French naval officers. And the reason for that is that, of course, in the novel, the ship they are chasing is American. For obvious reasons, they didn't want to do that in the movie. So they switched the nationality of the ship, but kept it as a commerce raider that was built in Boston. So it's sort of, the ship exists in a fuzzy area that doesn't quite make sense. They also, at the end, you can see that the ship is still flying the French tricolor after they've captured it, which obviously they wouldn't. I assume it's so that the audience doesn't look at it and go, wait a minute, where'd the second ship come from? To remind you that it's the captured French ship. I've heard from big naval historian nerds that there's some mistakes with like how the watches change and that, like, sometimes they ring the wrong bell, you know, because they would ring a bell, I believe, every 3 hours. And I think that sometimes they ring the bell, where like they ring the bell at night and you could tell that it's the morning bell call, not the night bell call. So that's the level of granular detail you have to get to find inaccuracies here. By and large, it is very true to life, to the point where actually a lot of the incidents in the movie are just sort of borrowed from real events. Yeah. For instance, that sequence where they do the decoy ship to fool the French to chasing this little like raft thing they've built while the real ship sails away. That really happened. That's basically just they changed the characters, obviously, because these are fictional characters, but that's a real event from the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah, and just on an aside about the fact that they changed the ship from American to French, this does smack of maybe something that is a little bit of the time, because just off the top of my head, I wrote them down. There are so many movies that are told from not America's perspective. You have something like Tora, 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 or Dances with Wolves, or The Last of the Mohicans, or Letters from Iwo Jima. Like, American audiences can take to a good war movie from a foreigner's perspective, but I think maybe 2003, they were just trying to minimize risk here, you know?
Well, I think it's a different matter. To say that, okay, the movie's not about Americans is one thing. To say, oh, the Americans are the bad guys in this movie is something different. I will say this, though, as an aside, this is loosely based on a real thing that happened. You know, this idea of a powerful enemy frigate going into the Pacific and the British trying to stop it. That really happened, and it was an American warship called the USS Essex. If you're ever interested in a good Wikipedia read that'll take you 15 minutes, look up the war cruise of the USS Essex, because it is a fascinating story.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and next, I just wanted to preface our discussion of the plot by talking about how this movie is essentially like a character study of a very specific type of guy that I think we all think is incredibly fascinating. And Jack Aubrey is a stand-in for a British naval officer of this era. And as you mentioned, the things that Jack Aubrey does are not so fantastic that they're made up, but these are often real maneuvers that were done by people like Lord Cochrane or like Nelson. And at first when I was watching this movie, I was like, oh, it's like Top Gun, you know, they're two rival fighter pilots. But then I kind of walked that back because I was thinking, these ships are like 40 times more complicated than a jet fighter. You can train to become a jet fighter in like 5 years, but to be a ship's captain, it takes generations. You're on the ship at 10 years old, learning every single position. The institutions required to create men like Jack Aubrey or like Lord Cochrane are incredibly deep. And so I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, like, how did society create these types of guys that were capable of commanding such an incredibly complicated ship and a fleet for that matter?
Yeah, that's very well said. You know, you hit the nail on the head there. There's a great line. It's actually about World War I, not World War II, but there's a great line. I believe it's from, I want to say it's Ernst Jünger. It's one of those World War I writers. He talks about this battle where, you know, classic early World War I battle where a bunch of infantry went over the top and all got massacred. And he talks about the fact that how do you see that happen to the wave in front of you and then go up yourself when the time comes? And he says that, you know, it took centuries of love to create men who were willing to do that. And there's something to that. It's like you said, it's not just about the individual incentives, or certainly not about the individual personalities that compose the officer corps of the Royal Navy. It's this extremely strict training regimen where these guys are basically raised by the institution from their preteen years, usually. Although some cases it's later, like for instance, Cochrane didn't join the Navy till he was 17. But these are really, they're products of the institution. In some ways, maybe more so than they are products of their own families. And it's an institution that is sort of focused on cultivating, you know, it's a strange mix because there's this very strict hierarchies and obedience. But then among the officers, there's also this culture of taking initiative and even exceeding one's orders sort of under the right circumstances. Because one thing to keep in mind about these ships, a modern naval vessel, no matter where it is in the world, it's never really out of the control of the government. And they just call them up and it's instant communication. These Napoleonic warships, they are out there and they're either with just their little squadron or division or whatever their fleet that they're in, or alone. Like the story we see in this movie is not at all unusual. And so they need to also cultivate this culture of like initiative and boldness and daring to keep things moving when there's no one, you know, there's no one making Aubrey do this stuff. It's got to come from within, because no one could make him do it because he's out there alone. If he was interested in doing the bare minimum and lazy and didn't care about the cause, well, he'd just sail around Brazil for a couple weeks and come back and say, yeah, I couldn't find the French ship. Sorry. Some of that is the, you know, king and country, these high ideals that get drilled into them as young men. As you can see from Aubrey's interactions with the midshipmen, how they're sort of being, you know, indoctrinated is the wrong word, but they're being introduced to certain ideas and ways of thinking about the world and themselves that would enable them to be good officers. There's that element to it, but there's also an element of money, getting paid. And they touch on this in the movie. They talk about the prize. That's one of Aubrey's war cries right when they board the ship, for the prize. That's money. He's talking about, let's all get paid. It's wrong to call these guys mercenaries, because they mostly were true believers. But there's that element. Nelson almost got himself killed in the Canary Islands on a mission that was purely about the payday.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that he approached the army and he was like, well, I'll split the loot with you. And the army was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, but he stood to make, in today's money, like several million dollars if that had gone off right. And that was part of this culture of boldness and risk-taking was, you know, if you are good at it, you can get rich.
Yeah, it's fascinating. As we'll get into, the movie portrays the ship as this place of rigid hierarchy, but it needs to balance this with this total freedom and boldness to make the complex system of moving parts on the ship and on the oceans generally to make it function.
Yeah, exactly. And then that, I think, mirrors a theme that you see in almost all Napoleonic fiction, which I think is actually a very good theme to explore and kind of why Napoleonic fiction is good, which is the conflict between reason and science and modernity modernity and progress and the demands of war. Because this is an era where that is really in stark relief, because as the movie portrays, I think very well, the officers of this era were crazy for science and culture and were by our standards extremely intellectual. I mean, not all the officers, obviously, some of them were barely literate, but by and large, this was an era where the people who were prosecuting this war and doing horrible things were often very kind of liberal-minded, forward-thinking people. And that's a fascinating conflict, and I think the movie does a really good job exploring that.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to talking a little bit about tone, because I think that the setting, the tone, the style of this movie is so important, because the plot is quite simple. It's about one boat chasing another boat. But the feel of the ship is, I think, really the value add that this movie presents, and one of the reasons I liked it so much. It's also probably a little bit why it was hard to market. I'll say I hadn't watched this movie in maybe in 20 years since I first saw it, and the one scene that I remembered vividly was when the little boy got his arm cut off, when the midshipman got his arm cut off. That stuck in my mind. And that happens early on in the movie, because it's trying to show you that this movie is not going to romanticize the age of sail like something like Pirates of the Caribbean. Doesn't shy away from portraying the amputation of the limbs of children, open-air brain surgery, privations of life on board a ship, a suicide that's caused by some boat lore-based superstition, and just these periods of extended boredom followed by periods of extreme danger. And of course, there's general like death and destruction when battle is joined. But I think what's so great about this movie is that there's a world where this could turn into just misery porn, something like Requiem for a Dream or Grave of the Firefly, something like that. But you still have these moments of levity and joy, like when the officers are dining and Russell Crowe makes this groaner of a pun about the lesser of two weevils. You see the men playing shanties, the enlisted men, and you see the officers play classical music. And you see them, you know, explore corners of the world, and you see wonder and marvel as they get to the Galapagos Islands. In conclusion, the Napoleonic ship is a land of contrasts when it comes to tones here. It's something that really stuck out for me.
Right. Yeah, and to me, I mean, that's so much of the appeal of this era, is that this is a time when the world is opening up in ways that, I mean, if you really, you know, if you want to like get stoned and really try to wrap your head around it and think about just how much was changing at this time and how people were having these opportunities that they never could have had before to have an impact on the world and to understand the world. And it's an era of just so much hope and optimism. And then at the same time, it's an era of just, I mean, the death is around every corner. A lot of people are living these lives of just horrible, grinding misery. And so it is this, you know, this contrast between this bright future that people are envisioning and the paradox that that dream of a bright future has brought a lot of violence into the world and has actually intensified the violence that was already in the world. And that's, I think, a lot of the romance of this era. And the movie, I think, does a really good job of communicating that. The books are written by someone with a love for this era, and I think the movie really brings that feeling onto the screen.
I agree. And that feeling is what the movie is about. And that's why it seems so out of place in this decade, because I remember someone trying to describe the plot to me. And for a big budget movie at that time, they fit a certain structure. And this movie is character driven and it's about the vibes, right? And so I can describe the other franchises and say, you know, Frodo is trying to save the world. Neo is trying to save the world. John Narnia is trying to save the world. I've never actually seen that movie, but I'm sure that's roughly the plot. And in this one, you know, it's about a captain trying to be good at his job. And it almost seems like kind of like a Michael Mann movie or something, in that it's character driven and about two guys who are very good at their job. And in terms of tone, you feel like you are on the ship with these guys. The movie is actually filmed on a real ship. Go look up a picture of the gimbal if you're listening. I'll put it in the show notes. They put a gigantic ship on a real gimbal in Baja California and shot these scenes with practical effects. It's really incredible. And the movie never cuts away back to England, you know, to the royals who are deciding what the Navy should be doing. It never even cuts to the opposing ship, which means that it's sort of a ship in a bottle episode. You are on the ship with the crew the entire time, which means that if they're out to sea for months at a time, that's where you are as a viewer. When they finally land on the Galapagos Island, which by by the way, they're the first movie to ever actually film on the Galapagos. When you get off the boat, when people are measuring birds and eating turtles, you are so excited to be off the boat for a moment, just as the crew is. You're like, yes. And when they show a cactus being boiled, it's the first time you've seen green food in forever. And like, yeah. I felt a sense of relief and like, oh, vitamin C. Thank God.
Which, by the way, they're not eating that. That's they're making liquor out of it.
Oh, okay. Right. I should have assumed.
Napoleonic sailors. Yeah. The eating greens, whatever. Drinking greens. That's what we're talking about.
And then when Jack orders them to get back on the boat, I was like, no, let me measure the birds. Come on, I'm having a good time here. I'm eating turtles. But it really is an experience, this movie. And I would love if movies like this still came out every weekend.
Yes. I actually was talking about this with someone with regards to 1917, which came out a couple years ago. And I mentioned to someone that there was an era where they were churning out a lot of movies like this, mostly about World War II. In like the early 60s, there was a new World War II movie like every week. Mm-hmm. And they're mostly extremely forgettable because they're basically focused, the forgettable ones, they're basically focused on just telling the story of some battle. And mm-hmm. that means that they've got an actor playing General Montgomery. They've got an actor playing Winston Churchill. They've got an actor playing Hitler. And it's kind of just like reading a textbook, but on the screen. Mm-hmm. And to me, if you're making a film of history, that's sort of not film's strong suit. Relaying just kind of factual information like that. You want a movie that mm-hmm. explores the feel, the vibe, yes. as you put it, that kind mm-hmm. of puts you in the shoes of the people who were there, that wonders, oh, what might this have looked like? What might that have looked like? That's what makes good historical fiction on the screen. And that's what this movie does. As you pointed out, there's no like guy playing Lord Nelson who we get to see in a flashback. There's no guy playing William Pitt who we get to have it, see him explain what's going on the ocean. Because that would be a waste. Because yeah. what's good about this movie is what's on the boat.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned drinking cactus liquor. I have one quick alcoholism question for you about alcoholism in the British Navy, because you said in one of your Nelson episodes that when they preserved his body in the cask of brandy, that's where we got the expression a drop of Nelson's blood. And if I understood you correctly, they needed to put armed guards to make sure people wouldn't drink the corpse wine. Was it that bad in the British Navy that people would drink brandy that had a corpse in it?
Well, that's something that you got to understand about this whole era is by our standards, a huge proportion of people in this era were alcoholics. Mm. Probably most of the decision makers and a very large portion of people in the military. Drinking was a huge part of military culture, and that was especially true in the Navy. One anecdote I've always liked is that Frederick the Great, so a generation earlier than this, wrote like a sort of basic, it's his standing instructions to his generals. So it's like a kind of like a little handbook of things you should always do when you're leading a Prussian army. Mm. And one of the very first things in it is about making sure that your men have enough booze because they might mutiny if they don't. So drinking, it's honestly hard to underestimate how much people were drinking at this time, mm-hmm. and especially in the military and especially in the Navy. It was just a massive, I mean, that was a big source of their recruits. The world was full of destitute drunks, and the Army and the Navy were places where, you know, hey, life is pretty bad, but you do get your half pint a day. So if you're wow. that hard up that a half pint a day might mean you're not going into DTs, mm-hmm. that's an option to consider, right? That's something I like about this movie, too, is they don't shy away from the fact that every time the officers are at their mess, they are mm-hmm. roaring drunk. Mm-hmm. And I really think that they could have sort of soft-pedaled that, and they do not at all. Alcohol was just a constant feature of life in this era, especially on the ocean.
Wow. Yeah, I couldn't imagine being hungover on a boat.
Yeah, as if it wasn't bad enough. Imagine waking up after sleeping in a hammock in like 100 degree heat after getting drunk the night before. Ugh.
Yeah, geez. All right, so that's our bit on the tone and the setting, which I think really are the movie strengths. I guess the one last thing I'll say, and we've already kind of mentioned it, is just, yeah, how sincere this movie is. It's been so long since I've heard a genuine action movie zinger.
I had no idea that a study of nature could advance the art of naval warfare. Now to pull this predator in close, let's bring our trap.
Jack.
Yes?
You're the predator.
And that ruled. Or even his inspirational rhetorical questions to the men. Do you want to see a guillotine in Piccadilly? Do you want to call that raggedy-ass Napoleon your king? Do you want your children to sing La Marseillaise? Now, I don't know if someone in 1805 would use the phrase raggedy-ass, but I was getting pretty pumped with the boys when I was watching.
I did an episode on the Battle of Trafalgar, and that was my favorite part of it, honestly, was the part right before the battle. There's three fleets of Trafalgar. Well, there's two fleets, three nationalities. There's the Spanish and the French who were allied, and then there's the British. And just kind of what's going on differently on those ships as they're getting the men hyped for battle. Master and Commander kind of shows you what they're doing on the British ships. On the Spanish ships, they pull out a crucifix, and they're all getting their final blessings before the battle. Extremely Catholic nation at the time. Mm-hmm. And on the French ships, they've brought out the eagles, which are given to the ships by Napoleon himself and, you know, touched by his hand. And they're all getting hyped up on kind of patriotic, you know, do you want to bow down to the King of England? No, long live the Emperor, long live the Revolution. And it's interesting to me that it's the same ritual, sort of, but just with kind of the spin of whatever is going on at that nation at the time is what they're turning to get their men hyped up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's finally turn to the plot quickly. We wanted to front load what we thought made this movie so unique, but if you haven't seen it, the plot of Master and Commander tells the story of the HMS Surprise and its crew's mission to track down and destroy a French privateer, the Acheron. I don't think they pronounce it that way in the film. Because the plot is about chasing down and taking down this French ship that is much, much stronger. It's bigger, it has more guns, has a larger crew, it has more developed technology in its hull so the cannonballs can't penetrate it. It really is a classic cat and mouse naval engagement that it made me think of The Wrath of Khan or even something like The Hunt for Red October, some of these submarine movies. High stakes, high tension, naval warfare. And they establish this from the very first scene when our heroes are attacked. And so our ship, the British ship that we're on, needs to use guile, grit, seamanship to make up for these material differences and take down the French vessel. And that's the plot of the movie.
And I was shocked to find out what a force multiplier a good captain could be in real life. So the guy that Jack Aubrey is based off of, Thomas Cochrane, once in a naval battle with the Spanish, he had a crew of 54 men and 14 guns, and he captures an enemy ship that has 319 men and 32 guns. He fought a larger ship with six times as many guys and only lost three sailors because of good leadership and aggressiveness. And so I do have a question for you here because I just cannot make sense of this in my mind. How is this possible that you can swing over to an enemy ship with a sixth the number of guys, only take three losses and capture a ship? The value of a good leader just seems to be so incredible on the sea.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And, you know, this is not just one incident. So this is something that blew my mind when I was researching that Trafalgar episode. Throughout the Napoleonic Wars, the consensus among modern historians is that, well, it's a fact that France and her allies built more warships during that period. And it is the consensus among modern historians that the French, Spanish, and Americans were all better at building warships than the British. And if you look at the battles, you know, for instance, the Nile, which they mention during Master and Commander, one of the great British naval victories of this era, the British are all older than the French warships and smaller. So this is not like, you know, oh, this is the one incident where Cochrane managed to pull this off because he's a genius. This is sort of the story of the competing navies in this era. The leadership and the skill of the men is the X factor that enables you to triumph. It almost doesn't matter that the French are able to build better ships because the British just take them. You know, by the end of the war, a huge proportion of the Royal Navy's vessels are captured French, Spanish, Danish, American, whatever, warships. And it's because their navy is big enough that it can absorb the losses of the war in manpower, and the French Navy is not. And so they're at a point where the French Navy is, by the end of the Napoleonic Wars, almost broken just because they can't get experienced sailors, they can't get experienced officers because their officers die or get captured as they're rising through the ranks. As you pointed out earlier, it takes decades to make a naval officer. If you lose a bunch of these guys, it's not like you can just hire more. The British can do that because they have this really powerful institution in the Royal Navy and this massive merchant fleet. It's kind of in the background of the movie, but when they rescue those whalers and the whalers get absorbed into the crew, and then at the end, he tells his second in command, who's taken command of the captured French ship, to appoint the leader of the whalers as his second in command. So that guy's just part of the team now, even though he's some civilian, because the British merchant fleet was that good that they could just pick a guy who was an experienced captain in, and he's probably pretty good. The French didn't have the luxury of doing that. Actually, by kind of midway through the Napoleonic Wars, the French are just conscripting people and putting them on ships. So people with no maritime experience having to learn all that stuff on the fly, whereas the British Navy, a large majority of the men on those ships either are career Royal Navy men or are experienced sailors, fishermen, whalers, whatever, who know how to be on a ship and know how to do their jobs and have been conscripted into the Navy. And so having these officers with decades of experience, these men who actually know what they're doing, it almost doesn't matter what ship you're on, because if you have that mix of people trained in the culture of the Royal Navy, they can make it happen. They have the skills to make it happen, whatever needs to happen. And it's funny that you brought up the Wrath of Khan, because I think that Star Trek has really, that's kind of the model for a lot of how Star Trek stories work. And indeed, when they were creating Star Trek, Thomas Cochrane was the guy they chose to base James Kirk on.
Nice.
Wow.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah, Cochrane. So he's got Horatio Hornblower is based on Cochrane. Jack Aubrey is based on Cochrane. And James Kirk is based on Cochrane. So I think most people don't know his name, but he's actually a weirdly influential figure in popular culture.
That's crazy. That's awesome. Yeah. And it's so funny because I know, like, you think about the French Revolution, you think about the French really bringing in meritocracy into the army, you know, promoting people who are good at warfare. But, you know, like you just said, if it takes so long to get that much better at naval warfare, you can't do the same thing. You can't do the reforms on sea that they did on land, right?
On land, they're relying on sort of audacity and courage and commitment and ideological fervor to sort of get them over the hump that they are missing from all the officers deserting, which happened in both the Army and the Navy. But in the Navy, you actually see the French captains before Trafalgar saying stuff like that, like, hey, the British are more experienced, but, you know, we've got the guts. And it just shows you that that does not work on the water, because there's an anecdote I've always loved. At the end of Trafalgar, a horrible storm blew in the very next day. And the British captains, all of the British captains who survived the battle instantly knew that was coming because they felt the wave. And there's a certain kind of wave that you get when there's a storm a certain distance away. And literally just these guys, imagine how distracted they must have been right after the biggest naval battle of all time at that point. And they're still aware enough and in tune enough with what's going on with their ships and the water that they just kind of feel that little shake. And they all go, oh no, there's a storm, you know, X miles away. And they instantly know that. You can't just kind of fake that if you have enough courage. You have to really, really know your business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just getting back to our story here. Jack and the ship's orders are to follow the Archeron up to Brazil, but it quickly becomes sort of a Captain Ahab and a white whale obsession for Russell Crowe's Captain Aubrey. They round Cape Horn in a storm to keep following the ship, and they end up in the Pacific. The ship is damaged, and Jack keeps following him, even though they don't need to anymore, technically, according to his orders.
Yeah, I would say in meme terms, in modern day meme terms, this plot vacillates between the meme, we're so back, to it's so over, and bounces between them. So in quick succession, they use this stratagem with a raft and fire in the middle of the night to drop behind the French ship. We're so back. But then they round Cape Horn, they lose a mast as well as some men. It's so over. They make it to the Galapagos for repairs, and then they get some intel from some whalers on the last known location of the Acheron. We're so back, but the ship is becalmed in the wind, and a midshipman commits suicide, thinking that he's what the movie calls a Jonah, the cursed sailor, and the cause of all their misfortunes. It's so over. And then the ship's doctor is shot in this absolutely bumbling ship's accident. He gets shot in the gut. It's never been more over, and so on and so forth. The movie kind of alternates. It emphasizes all of the different kinds of things that can go wrong out there on the open ocean, on the far side of the world.
Yeah, and that's kind of the story of naval combat in this era. The main reason the British were able to win at the Nile, obviously Nelson's genius was part of it, but a lot of the reason that the British were able to win is that the French fleet was completely exhausted. All their ships were damaged. They didn't have enough food and water, and they sent almost half their sailors ashore to just try to find, you know, our fleet is fucked. Find us, you know, something to fix it with. And so when the British arrive, a lot of the French sailors are not back at their ships. So really, it's about who can outlast the other side just in not dying out there.
The climax of the plot of the movie, the final battle, involves the captain being inspired by the humble stick bug to disguise his ship as a whaler, to make the French ship come to him. Then, once they're really close, they have have one shot at a broadside. The English win. Russell Crowe promotes one of his men to captain and puts him on the French vessel to sail it back as a prize. But what a twist. The French have pulled a ruse of their own. And it turns out that the ship's doctor who presented the saber to Russell Crowe to surrender the vessel was in fact the French captain in disguise. And this is one of the last scenes of the movie, is Russell Crowe realizing that he has been had by a ruse, which is kind of like a, I laugh, but it's like them trying to set up a sequel, I think, in some ways. But yeah, I guess the question that we had is presenting the saber not binding by some kind of rules of sea honor?
Well, it's funny, there's no law, of course, but it was, in a very real sense, binding. I mean, these guys really did adhere to a code of naval combat, and handing over the captain's sword, no matter who does it, that's like a contract. There's a great anecdote where a French ship was captured by the British. They put a crew on it and sail it away to take it as a prize. And then the storm hits and the ship starts to sink. And there's more French prisoners than there are British crew. And the French prisoners know the ship, and the ship seems like it might be sinking. And so they're like, are we just going to sit here in the hold as prisoners and just die because the British can't control the ship? And they decide, no, we shouldn't just let ourselves die. We got to retake the ship somehow. And they're like, wait a minute, we took an oath to the British captain. We can't just violate our oath. So they delegate one of their guys who speaks English to wave to the guard, say, I need to talk to the captain. He gets led to the captain and basically says, look, I'm very sorry, but I have to inform you that we no longer feel bound by our contract and we are going to rebel.
Yeah, I humbly regret to inform you that we are in open rebellion.
But they really took that stuff seriously. So yeah, handing over the sword was definitely binding. I think to me, that little note at the end is showing you that any obligation to the war effort has been satisfied. It's showing you that this is ultimately a personal thing for Aubrey. Mm-hmm. It's not over for him until he looks the French captain in the eye and kind of gets a reckoning for all the times the French captain tricked him.
Mm.
So that's how I read that.
No, that's good. I like that.
And we'll talk about this more in a moment, because I think that the surrender system has to have a structure to it, just because the environment they're operating in is so chaotic that you're risking everybody drowning to death unless you have some kind of procedure for surrender. And it was always sort of confusing to me, you know, sea honor, because on one hand, you were bound by some kind of oath, but there's a lot of trickery with the way that these ships would sometimes attack each other, switching their flags or disguising as a whaling ship.
Which some of that stuff is actually technically against. I mean, you know, it's funny, people act like, oh, these old codes of honor were so strict. And in a certain sense, they were, but they also violated them all the time. So it's really, you know, there's a push and pull there. You know, famously, Nelson, there was a Battle of Copenhagen, one of the really kind of iconic battles of his career. And he was losing. He was actually pretty convincingly being defeated by the Danes. And they had really kind of pulled out all the stops to fight the British and had actually taken on a bunch of volunteers. They had more ships than they did sailors. And so the government just put out a call like, hey, if you're willing to go fight on a ship, go to the harbor now. And Nelson basically, he's losing the battle. And so he sits down on his deck and writes a note and says, get this to the Danish commander somehow. And the note is basically a very polite threat that, hey, I know you've got this little area where you've got all these kind of disabled ships that only have volunteers on them. I'm going to burn them all unless you surrender. So, and the Danes backed down and Nelson won the battle. So basically he won the battle on, I'll kill a bunch of your civilians if you don't give in. That's not very chivalrous.
Every British man shall do his duty burning the Danish civilian ships.
So just before we introduce the themes, it's important to talk about the two characters that this movie is about. Our two leads here, we've mentioned at length Jack Aubrey, who's our swagged out captain of the HMS Surprise, but he's also joined by his good friend Stephen Maturin, who's the ship's doctor, and he's sort of a nerd, you know. He's a gentleman naturalist, I guess is a better way to put it.
Man of letters is what we called nerd back then.
Yes. And yeah, a lot of commentators like to talk about how different these men are. And I agree with them to a point, but I think this movie is about how these two men who are superficially quite different are actually quite the same. Like, I wouldn't go all the way to say it's a buddy cop movie, but I think there's a little bit of buddy cop in his DNA. Because if you do the comparing contrast, we have the captain is this thoroughly practical man. He's skeptical of Dr. Maturin's natural federalist tendencies because he doesn't see their practical technological applications when it comes to naval warfare. He's super competent and all the men look up to him because of it. Multiple characters say something along the lines of, "That's the finest seamanship I've ever seen."
"Death. In all my years, I've never seen the like. It has to be more than 100 sea miles and he brings us up on his tail. That seamanship, Mr. Pullings. My God, that seamanship."
And he's this true believer in the rules, regulations, and missions of the British Navy. His men respect him, but he keeps them at arm's length. And you even see him believe a little bit in this ship superstition, like the Jonah. He says, you know, there are some things that can't be explained by science or what have you. And on the other hand, Paul Bettany's Stephen Maturin is soft-spoken. For any German philosophy fans out there, he wears the tiny little Max Stirner glasses. And he's just insatiably curious about the natural world and knowledge for the sake of knowledge. One of the things that they beef over is that he is less enamored with hierarchy. One of their big conflicts has to do with whether or not flogging is justified. Flogging specifically over the issue of saluting an officer. So flogging that has to do itself with the reinforcing of hierarchy. And, you know, he's a bit of an outsider because he's meant to be half Irish, half Catalan. But like any good buddy cop movie, they're actually quite similar. They're both competent. They both have a tendency towards obsession over their goals. And yeah, I mean, they both eventually kind of become more like one another in the end.
Yeah, and I think that relationship, you know, I mentioned earlier that in a lot of Napoleonic fiction, there's this tension between the demands of war and the modern state. And then on the other hand, reason and progress and modernity. And I think that you see that, you know, in the characters as well. Obviously, they're not caricatures. They are good, well-realized characters, but you can see Dr. Maturin clearly more on the reason, progress, enlightenment side, and Aubrey ultimately comes down more on the demands of the service, as he puts it.
Yeah, and I think their relationship is a huge part of what makes this movie so great. We keep saying it's a character study, but it's great to see them fight. It's great to see them support one another. It's great to see them grow and change for one another. They're well-realized characters with arcs, and they even jam together. One of them plays a violin, the other one plays a cello. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that they jam twice in the movie, and the first time one of them is plucking and then the other one is using the bow, and then in the second time they jam together after they've learned from each other, you know, they've switched and the other one is strumming and the other one is using the bow. It's really interesting how they both learn the values of the other and how they're made better by that compromise and being open to friendship.
Well, I think that they've realized that they are in many ways two sides of the same coin, and I think that the movie sort of wants us to understand that as well, and that not only are these two men two sides of the same coin, the values they represent are also two sides of the same coin.
You know, there's some discourse online about what this movie is about, and I think that it potentially is a non-toxic dudes rock movie. I have heard some other podcasts say that this is a gay movie, and I wanted to see that going into it. I think the most homosexual part of the movie is that it takes place within the British Navy. But Ben, what was that quote you had from Winston Churchill?
Yeah, it's rum, sodomy, and the lash, right? Is what Churchill called the traditions of the Royal Navy.
We'll say this about that quotation. There is another view of that, which I've found interesting. And I don't know quite enough to have strong views on this myself, but there is a view out there among naval historians that homosexuality on ships of this era, actually not all that common, especially on bigger ships. There actually were women on board and they were there. I mean, a lot of them were sex workers, and that's what they were there for. Captive audience, as they say. And you don't find tons and tons of evidence of homosexuality on these ships. Of course, you wouldn't. You know, people tend not to, you know, no one's diary is, "I had a great time buggering Jim last night." But what we do find is persistent evidence of sort of a certain type of person worrying about homosexuality on these ships. And so the thought is that maybe some of our view of that is just colored by prudish moral panic about what might happen with so many low-class men away from civilization altogether. That's really, in some ways, more of a reflection on the people who are talking about it than the people who are actually out there on the ships. But again, I'm not taking a strong view on that one way or the other. I don't know. I'm just, it's an interesting argument.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because watching this movie is about two male friends who support each other. And if that makes a movie gay, then it's kind of sad because it basically means that any healthy heterosexual friendship is an
inherently gay, which I disagree with. You know, I think that you could have a non-toxic male friendship that is platonic.
That's actually honestly a big part of this era. Masculinity in this era is extremely different from the way we understand it today. One anecdote I've always liked, there's a great paper out there, I'm forgetting who wrote it now, about how British men responded to Nelson's death. And this scholar went through a bunch of letters and diaries and records of conversations, talked about how these guys are actually trying to one-up each other and outdo each other over how depressed they are. You know, guy writes to his friend and said, oh, I haven't been able to eat for a week. I'm so sad. I just am despondent that, you know, our nation's greatest hero is dead. And then his friend writes back, oh, you haven't been able to eat? I haven't been able to sleep. My wife is worried about me. And the idea of men bragging about how much they're weeping over the death of another man, now that seems so weird, right? But back then, you were a manly man if you were weeping over war and your nation's sorrows. And their friendships were very close. There's a great anecdote about Napoleon where him and one of his friends are walking around in Paris during the Thermidorian reaction, when there are these street gangs of kind of outlandishly dressed right-wing youth all over Paris. That was kind of the style of the time. And Napoleon is kind of dismissive of these guys, and they're walking around making fun of them and saying they look like, you know, basically that they look kind of gay. Not in those words, but, you know, they all look at these fancy boys. And at the end of the anecdote, it mentions just offhand that Napoleon and his friend are hand in hand as they're walking together. So they're just just two men strolling down the streets of Paris hand in hand, making fun of all the queers they see. It's just, you know, it does not happen now. And it's just, yeah, it just goes to show you that things were different back then when it came to men's relationships with other men.
Yeah, something I learned from you is that the last thing Lord Nelson ever does is ask his friend for a kiss.
Right, yeah. Kiss me, Hardy.
Actually, we might as well ask this now, but Ben and I were just debating whether or not there was a line in that movie and in the book, and we're not sure if it's sincere or if he's doing a bait and switch joke, but when he says that Nelson told him something and he'll never forget it, and it was, can you pass me the salt? And we weren't sure, is he joking or is he such a fanboy that this has actually stuck with him with this impact that he's describing?
I took that as, if you recall, it's the young midshipman who's like, oh, tell me something about Nelson. And he tells him that, you know, he sets him up like it's going to be some profound thing. And then he tells the joke. And there's a shot where you can see that the kid is kind of disappointed. You know, he laughs a little bit, but he's a little bit like, I wanted to hear a story. And then he tells the second story. So I think he sees that the kid is a little disappointed and is like, okay, I'm going to tell him a real story.
Yeah, I definitely read it as a bait and switch, because one of the things that I love about Captain Jack Aubrey in this movie is that, yes, he's this competent seaman captain, as everyone keeps saying, but he also has this corny sense of humor, whether that's the groaner of a pun or in this bait and switch about, can you pass the salt?
Well, I mean, it's a dad joke, right? And he is kind of the dad of those midshipmen, which they show. I think they don't spend a lot of time with the midshipmen in this movie, but I do like that they do focus on them a bit. And that is part of the scene of the ship, is that there are these young kids who are like basically the naval interns.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that this is a nice place to move into the themes of this movie. And we only have two here, but the first one is just this conflict between obsession and compromise.
Yeah, I watched a lot of reviews of this movie in preparation to do this. And a lot of people, they take the polar opposites view of our two leads, right? But what I love about this movie is that the characters' arcs mirror each other. And so Captain Jack can't let go of his prideful obsession to capture the Acheron, even though he's fulfilled his orders and his duty, even to the point of endangering his crew. He is going to find this ship, damn it. But he learns and he grows. And the thing that makes him let go of this prideful obsession, and literally Dr. Maturin says is about his pride, is when his friend is injured. When someone's trying to shoot like an albatross and accidentally shoots Stephen Maturin in the gut, they have to go to dry land. They have to abandon the chase so that Maturin can perform surgery on himself. So when his friend's life is in danger, he's able to let go of both his selfish obsession and the mission. But then immediately afterwards, when Stephen Maturin is going around the Galapagos collecting birds and hiking, trying to find the flightless cormorant, he has a moment of crisis where he sees the French ship in a cove and he needs to run back to warn his friend, we got the ship, we got them dead to rights. But in order to do this, because he's still injured, he needs to let go of all of his birds. and the awards he would have gotten from the Royal Society, but he does it for friendship. They both are obsessed and prideful and, you know, ambitious in different ways, but both of them have a moment of crisis where they need to let go for the other person, for their friendship. It's the kind of thing that you can do in historical fiction because they're not real. Whereas if we got a faux realistic movie, you couldn't have this elegant paralleled character arc.
As an aside, it's pretty wild. I kind of did not pick up on this until this most recent rewatch. They sort of imply that Dr. Maturin might have discovered the theory of the origin of species had he been given a little more time on the island, which is kind of wild, actually.
Yes. Yeah. That is the closest to the movie kind of winking at the audience, you know, like a little Easter egg for the history heads, you know. You don't like to see when historical movies know where history is going and characters have obnoxious foreshadowing lines. Like I've been rewatching Rome for this show, our podcast, and it's a great show that I love a lot. But you will have a character say something like, "Ooh, I'm so mad I could stab Caesar." It's like, come on, man.
Going back to the theme you're talking about, I like that sort of obsession versus compromise. The Duelist also has that element of it.
Mm.
And you find it in a lot of Napoleonic fiction. And I think that's because it sort of mirrors what's going on in the world at that time, where you have these sort of not terribly different countries that are locked in mortal combat. And there's this feeling that if just one of them were willing to back down, that maybe didn't need to happen.
Mm.
You know, if Napoleon had maybe been willing to, you know, his foreign policy got very personal towards the end of the Napoleonic Wars, where he's punishing people who he feels have wronged him or who have behaved badly. Similarly, on the British side, their obsession with restoring the old regime in France, you could look at it in a similar light. And so I think that's a very interesting and useful theme, kind of just as part of the setting, on top of just, you know, being well explored in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was recently Bastille Day, and some right-wing accounts on Twitter that I hate watch are trying to say that Bastille Day is bad and shouldn't be celebrated, right?
Yeah, that's been an interesting thing I've noticed popping up in Twitter moron discourse lately, is the French Revolution is really coming to the forefront in a way that makes it pretty clear that the people talking about it don't really know what happened.
Yeah, let's take one of the most famously complicated events in history that people have written entire volumes over, you know, pouring over it week by week, 1789, 1793, and let's just be like, you know what? Bad. Not good. What an astute observation.
I would have done it differently if I'd been there, I'll tell you what.
If I had been in that Bastille,
things would have gone down a little bit.
I was just going to move us on to our next theme here. Something that was really interesting in this movie was the nature of hierarchy and order versus anarchy. Because when you are adrift on the far side of the world in an environment that can kill you at any moment, you need structure and hierarchy. Yeah. And, you know, no one does structure and hierarchy like the British, famously.
Maybe the Germans.
Yeah, that's true. It's too bad they don't have more ports. But the British class system on the ship is as strong as it is on land. The movie makes a point several times to show you that there is this divide between the officers and the sailors, and that it's important to keep this divide present.
Right. I think that subplot with the Jonah does a really good job of exploring that. That really, the hierarchy feels so strict as an outside observer from modern times looking back on it. But then when you really kind of break down the dynamics of these ships, in a certain sense, it is kind of hanging by a thread.
Mm-hmm.
That thread is the authority of the captain and the officers.
Yeah. And the scene in which that kind of middling midshipman,
that guy is both a midshipman and a midshipman.
Nice. That midshipman is not saluted. And then one of the crewmen is flogged publicly. And the scene afterwards where he walks down under the ship and is cramped and claustrophobic. And there's just this throng of shirtless crewmen who are all standing up and saluting him in unison. They look like zombies.
They're clearly deliberately being menacing to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great scene. I wrote a thing years ago, about 10 years before the setting of this movie, there were horrible mutinies in the the British Navy. That actually, I mean, at the time, the British government downplayed how bad they were because it really seemed like they might lose control of big parts of the Navy to these sort of councils of sailors who had taken over these ships. And there is a push and pull to these things, to these relationships, despite the hierarchy. And that's part of what makes the life on these ships so fascinating, is that the captain, you know, when Aubrey's trying to give advice to that terrible midshipman, he says, you know, don't be a tyrant. That's part of the advice, because this is not a purely one-way relationship where the officers dictate and the men obey. There is a push and pull, and there's almost like proto-labor unrest on these ships sometimes, where the men refuse to do certain duties or find little unofficial ways to act out, to voice their displeasure if they're angry about something. And it is, even in this relationship of domination, it's reciprocal, because at the end of the day, they all are crammed together on this little tiny vessel together. They have to cooperate to survive. I think they do a really good job getting into that, because without that subplot, it might seem like it's just, you know, the sailors are automatons and the captain commands and they do what he says.
Yeah. Even the enlisted men have their spaces that are not meant to be infringed upon.
Yes, absolutely.
Like when they're singing a shanty, and the midshipman joins in and singing, and they all stop. And he has just managed to piss everyone off, because the officers are disappointed in him for crossing this class threshold, as are the enlisted men.
Right. And then similarly, when Maturin brings up the idea of tossing the grog overboard, and Aubrey's like, absolutely not. One of the things he says is, he says like something like along the lines of, oh, throw away 200 years of tradition and privilege. Privilege. I mean, we don't think of Napoleonic sailors as having privilege, but that's very much what that was. It was their right to get drunk.
I do find it interesting and very fitting for this theme that the way that they are able to win in the climax of the movie is by explicitly rejecting that rigidity and hierarchy. They pretend to be the whaling ship, and while they're doing that, one of the sailors salutes, and Russell Crowe, I believe, has to tell him, don't salute me, like, this is a whaling ship. And so they have to throw away this hierarchy in order to be successful in their attack, which I thought was very funny and fitting for, like, one of the big themes of this movie.
It's one of the themes of the era, is that these old regime powers want to defeat France because they're so horrified by the egalitarian, well, not quite egalitarian, but egalitarian-ish, say, system in France, and they've got to adopt the methods of the revolutionaries to defeat the revolutionaries. So that's, you know, that's reflective of a very real dynamic.
Yeah, because of course, at a high level, the British are fighting against a revolutionary society that they perceive as being anarchy, right? They need to restore order and hierarchy to this country. And so there's a lot happening here with the nature of anarchy and order on the ship. The ship is England.
class system and all. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that they get away with pretty much telling you that, right? I mean, the ship is England. It's presented as kind of a poetic thing, but they are, in another sense, pretty explicitly saying, hey, by the way, this can also be read as a symbol for what is going on in England at this time.
England is under threat of invasion, and though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is our home. This ship is England.
Yes, they might as well have just said, this ship is an allegory, as their battle cry.
Okay, so that wraps up themes. Our final section, we always like to talk about echoes in the culture and maybe how this movie could be felt today in some way. And I think the most interesting thing about this movie is that there are no echoes in the culture, unfortunately. This is the greatest franchise that never was. They had 20 novels to work with. They very much could have made more of these movies. But, you know, sadly, the movie only made $1/5 of $1 billion. And the studio was like, we'll never financially recover from this.
Yeah, solidarity with the striking writers and actors. This movie didn't make enough money at only $200 million to warrant a second one. So
yeah, you know, I was kind of looking up in preparation of coming here, when exactly did this come out? I'd forgotten. It came out like right when we invaded Iraq. Mm-hmm. Maybe the worst time in recent American history for sort of a nuanced portrayal of war, because people were not feeling the nuance in 2003.
Yeah, absolutely. And it came out during the Lord of the Rings year at the Oscars. So this thing won 2 of the technical Oscars. It won, I think, cinematography and sound design. It should have. It rocks.
It's a movie, yeah.
When it's chaotic in battle, the camera's shaky. When they start to be more disciplined, when they're training to take take down the Asher home, the camera's more still. Like, it is one of those almost every frame of painting films, but it was never going to get Oscar love because the Lord of the Rings Return of the King took all of them that year.
That's depressing to think.
Think for a second about how crazy it is that there are so few echoes in the culture from this movie. If you're a longtime Shufflehead listener, you'll know that for our first 10 episodes, almost without fail, we would have to say, oh, and there's a reboot in the works. Oh, and there's a sequel in the works. And this is for shit that was bad a lot of the time. They made a How I Met Your Father sitcom on Hulu. They made a Jackass 4. There's a Boondock Saints 3 in the works. Pop culture products that were mid to bad to begin with is worthy of a sequel or reboot treatment. But somehow, this awesome, well-made, well-executed, well-acted, well-written film is just totally consigned to the dustbin of history.
It did kind of have a bit of a meme renaissance recently.
Yeah.
Like a gentleman had tattooed, the year is 1805, the oceans are now battlefields, tattooed onto their back. And so it was good to see it getting some love in pop culture.
I have a slight bone to pick with that. Napoleon was not really the master of Europe until like 1807, 1806 maybe. 1805, I know why they did it. They wanted to set it before the death of Nelson so that Nelson would be this looming figure rather than, you know, canonized secular saint as he was immediately after his death. But it's still an iconic, you know, I love that has become a meme. I'm not sure if that has any broader cultural significance beyond the fact that it's a good movie and a lot of people liked it. But it is not entirely accurate, I would say.
So yeah, our closing thoughts here, other than the thing we've said many times, the Napoleonic ship is a land of contrast. I think that historical fiction is a really big missed opportunity for movies. I think that, Everett, like you were saying, these kinds of movies that are meant to teach you dates and battles like a history textbook are not good movies. I think history should be used as a backdrop to kind of capture what it was like at that time, what it might have been like to live through times that are so different, almost unfathomably different from your own. Unfathomably is an inadvertent naval pun. I apologize for that. But it really does seem like audiences don't know what to do when their historical fiction is fiction and presented as fiction.
Well, I'll say this, though. 1917 is in some ways a similar movie. Mm-hmm. I would say Master and Commander is a lot better than 1917. But I think 1917 is similar in the sense that it's mostly focused on what would this have been like if you were there? Mm-hmm. Think of all the crazy sights that you would have seen and all the weird things that would have happened to you and just how different your life would be if you were living at the front in World War One. And it's not really focused on the big battles and teaching you about the different personalities that were important. They don't cut away to General French at any point. They don't cut away to Lloyd George at any point. It's just, it's showing you a day in the life of this guy. And I would criticize that much more than Master and Commander with how they approached that. But I think it's similar in the sense that they are just doing away with the boring stuff and trying to focus on what makes an historical film interesting, which I really appreciate.
Yeah. It's so funny that you bring up 1917 because I thought about that movie so many times when I was thinking about this movie's place in the decade and thinking about, oh, I wish movies still came out like this every weekend, like a character-driven, big-budget drama. And I subconsciously was thinking about 1917, but I didn't know why. And you've just articulated exactly why I kept thinking about it. And it's because it's not about World War One explicitly in the sense that you're learning about the battle that changed the course of the war or anything.
Yeah, because there wasn't one. Right. Famously. It's a stalemate.
There is that scene in 1917 where he runs into an officer and the officer's talking about the big push and how they're finally making more than 5 miles a day or whatever. But then that immediately fades back into the background, which I think is a nice touch.
I think that they're both the same sort of movie. And I had such fond memories of going to see 1917 and thinking, I wish I could do this every week. Because most of the movies that come out now are not character driven and they have a very light and self-aware tone in which the audience is sort of being winked at when the hero says some kind of meta commentary on the situation or something. And both of those movies are, sincere pieces of historical fiction driven by a character.
Yeah. All right. I think that's all we got for today. As we wrap up, I want a huge thank you to Everett Rummage from the Age of Napoleon podcast for coming on Remember Shuffle to review this 20-year-old film.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And do you have anything you want to plug other than Age of Napoleon?
Just the Age of Napoleon. That pretty much much takes up all my time.
Nice.
Yeah, I would recommend, by the way, checking out your series on Horatio Nelson within the Age of Napoleon podcast.
Yeah, that's worth bringing up. If you don't want it the full experience, there is a series of 4 episodes on Nelson that would rhyme with this movie quite a bit. And there's also, I think maybe my personal favorite episode is the episode on Trafalgar, which really gets into, you know, this shows us the smallest possible view, just the ship. And that episode will give you a view of a whole battle. So like zooming out slightly and seeing a whole fleet rather than just one ship.
Awesome. Well, yeah. As I always say, like, subscribe to Remember Shuffle, tweet about us, TikTok or Instagram. I don't know. Giordano handles that side of the business. And we'll see you next time. Ciao, ciao.
Ship sailing, Bristol fashion. Ahoy, ahoy. All right. Bye, everybody.
Farewell and adieu to you Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you ladies of Spain. For we've received orders but to sail for old England. But we hope in a short time to see you again. We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. All you shanter silly. Thank you.